Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Context. I'm your host, Kate Langsdorf, and with us all today, we've got my buddy Bernardo from Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas, where he works on the grants. Bernardo, can you introduce yourself and say who you are and like what you do in your very own words?
Yeah, definitely.
Super duper.
Hi, Deva. I'm Bernardo. I am the Vice President of Grants and Awards for the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. And even as I say this, I'm contemplating what might be the day we just call ourselves the Dramaturgs of the Americas for my political bias. You know what I mean? What else did you ask me?
Who you are, what you do. Well, first of all, I'm glad that you said your name because I've mostly been have I entirely just read your name? Because most of our relationship is email based.
Yeah.
I'm not rolling my R's right.
Most people,
I'm making a note right now.
it's weird because growing up, everyone would just say Bernardo,
Bernardo.
or they would say Bernardo. But now that I'm in the theater world, where there I'm interacting with a lot more, I'm not going to say white people because I passionately believe in what is the existence of white people across Latin America. Although some people really don't like to be called Anglo, but English speakers. Now that I'm around so many solely English speakers, who are so politically sensitive and considerate, I hear people sometimes be like, Bernardo.
Yeah,
Like,
that's kind of where I am. Like I want to I'm trying to be the woke white lady, but like the ways in which I am not as equipped as I want to be are apparent like every day. And this is really relevant to the stuff that we're going to be talking about today. So I want to make sure that I'm saying your damn name right.
Bernardo is in every way fine. If you want to adventure to say Bernardo, or if you want to, if that's difficult, I won't get frustrated or offended.
So last name, is it Maison? Or am I just below that?
My father's patriarchal last name is Masson,
Maison.
and my mother's patriarchal last name is Dacher.
Okay, Maison is the only one that shows up in my from field when I get an email from you.
Interesting. Well, yeah, my email address is Mason Bernardo, and I created that address particularly because it'd be shorter, and I didn't want
Okay.
to. Yeah. And it was my way of adhering back then to what is the U.S. system of, like, your one last name, which comes from your parent, which comes from your male parent.
But in real life, you.
Well, I've always thought of myself by my three names.
Okay.
My
So.
elementary school stuff does show that I only wrote Bernardo on my phone at the time because that's what they would ask for. But, like, my parents always told me, in Mexico, these are your last names.
These are your last names. Yeah. That is good. So we're gonna keep all of this, even though there was a lot of botching, but I think that on my part, but I think that it is instructive and necessary. And I'm also going to just introduce you again, see if I do any better. Hi,
Okay.
everybody. Welcome to The Context. This is Kate Langsdorf. I'm here with my guest, Bernardo Maison de. Oh, God damn it.
Want to
Bernardo
hear me
de.
say my name? Is that going to help?
Here's my guest. What's your name, friend?
Bernardo Masson Dacher.
Dacher. Did I get that part? That sounded like a Norwegian-y French thing that I just did, and I don't think that was right.
It's Arabic. It's Dacher.
Dacher. Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Although I typically, like if I'm auditioning or if I'm interviewing, I just tell people, "Hi, I'm Bernardo," because it's not only is it more tolerable, it's also, I guess, my way of refuting what is like the intrinsic patriarchy of the last name. Like regardless of whatever last name we ever have, it's always the fathers in our shared cultures.
Do you ever get, so I didn't know that you were also a performer, which is adds a whole new layer, I think, to the language and identity piece, because you have to come to these gatekeepers and be like, "Hello, this is how I present. Do I present the way that you want me to present for this thing that you're presenting?" Do you get do you find that you get pushback coming in? Like, is it be like, "I'm just gonna call you Bernie," or is it tend to be a little bit more respectful?
I mean, different people respond differently. I think I have seen it all, and even when I feel like I'm not one to ever be like, I was just discriminated against. Because I don't know, I grew up so privileged and on that side of, my Americanness or my whiteness. So I don't know how to recognize when I don't really know how to recognize macro inequities so easily. But I have seen some nastier shit, and I've also met some extremely kind people who understand.
So you live in San Diego right now, which is about as much of a border town as you can get, and you're not too far from me. We're in that so close but yet so far region where I'm in LA. I can get like I think I can get as far as South Orange County for a happy hour, and you can get what as far north as like Oceanside for a happy hour, and there's but we just like can't quite bridge that little gap to be able to get together in person. So we have never actually met in real life. Is that true? You weren't at the Berkeley conference, right?
I
Oh shit.
was, yeah. I was not yet VP, and I was not even yet really a member. I was still really
You were
experimenting.
you lurking?
I was lurking, yeah.
Okay, so we have been in the same room. I don't think we've had a conversation with each other's faces
No, I haven't.
before. Okay, cool. So I grew up in this area. I grew up in Orange County, mostly, and a little bit of LA County. Did you grow up in San Diego, or did you grow up in Mexico, or did you grow up in a different combination of places?
So I was born in Anaheim.
I was in Anaheim as a little kid, and then Irvine as a bigger kid.
Right on. I actually don't really know what it means to be from Anaheim, although everyone seems to have an association with it. Yeah. Well, we moved to Chula Vista when I was a year old.
That's closer to San Diego, right?
Yeah, Chula
Or
Vista is a municipality, a couple of municipalities below the San Diego proper city. And just for context, Chula Vista in my translation means fine ass view.
say it again, and what does it mean?
Fine ass view.
Oh, fine ass view. I like that.
That's my translation of it.
I mean, that's good. That sounds right.
Yeah, and it is comparatively the southernmost municipality of the United States continental territory. Yeah, when you say, it's as border town as border town gets, I'm like, yeah, I usually tell people I'm from SoCal, Southern California.
The deepest SoCal. I like it. So you said when you were three is when you moved there.
I was a year old,
Oh,
actually.
sorry, I just misheard all of it. Cool. Okay, so yeah, so I do understand why you don't have like a ton of Anaheim hometown pride, based
Exactly. I don't know
on
what it means.
what did you get in the first like 12 months of your life? Well, I was a guest on a different podcast that we recorded that last week, and we were talking about being from Anaheim and then moving and going to a school in coastal Orange County, and it sounds like, I don't know, as I said at the time, it sounds like a really kind of dumb thing to mention as a culture shock, but like being a North Orange County person versus being like a beachy Orange County person. Like I got to this school and everybody was blonde, everybody was like conventionally good looking and rich and going shopping and like on fire for Jesus in a really conservative Republican kind of way. And this was just going from one little Christian school in Orange to a slightly bigger Christian school in Costa Mesa. But like, there was so much more diversity even within basically like almost sister schools. But I'm like, where are my brown friends? This is weird. Why are you all, why do you all talk weird? Why you talk weird? Why am I ah? Anyway, Anaheim has is it's a, it just seems like a much better representation of all of America to me than a lot of the neighboring towns in Orange County, where you get kind of a cookie cutter person. That's a little bit more like the school I ended up at was more the what you see on TV when it's like Real Housewives of Orange County or the OC or like any of that. And you know what? This is something that you asked on a Facebook post a long time ago, is if white people or Anglo people had pinatas at the at birthday parties growing up. Yes, when I was in Anaheim and all my Anaheim friends were having birthday parties. And then thinking about it, never saw a pinata after I got to Costa Mesa.
You know, our listeners will never know why I'm beaming right now. The phone call I was having this morning with the playwright was somebody I'm collaborating with on what is a historical and cultural exploration of the piñata. And so when I posted that on social media, on this question, do white people use piñatas? It was actually research.
I figured it probably was.
Yeah, because I have no idea, and I still don't really understand. But
What were your findings of this research?
largely, that the white people in the United States know what a piñata is, and the white people from areas where there at least might be a Mexican presence do use piñatas for their children's birthdays.
Okay,
But
but like in Kansas, it's not happening.
I think it is because there's Mexican people in Kansas,
Right. Okay. Fair play.
but not, of course, everywhere in Kansas. Not to say that it's also everywhere in Mexico, but it's at least like a thought. Like,
It's
if
a
we get a
th right. Do
piñata,
we get the pinata? Yeah. What are we putting it? What shape should it be if we get one?
But what I will never really know, no matter how well I research or which questions I ask, is if it feels culturally distant for white Americans. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it didn't for me because I was from Anaheim. So, you know, most of my friends had parents who weren't born in this country. And it's not to say that they all had parents who were born in Mexico, even though that was a good chunk, but it was a really heavy immigrant population in our neighborhood. My brother's best friend was from Tibet. We had his other best friend was from Afghanistan, or the parents were, and the kids were, you know, first generation, and so we all just being like a little kid in that environment. Obviously, you got a pinata. Like, what are you just not having a party? So a lot of the little kid birthday markers and like festivity markers were coming out of the Mexican culture, because that was the culture of the neighborhood. But I could not tell you, you know, if I had grown up 15 minutes south, if that was going to be like in, you know, which is still, this is like richer Orange County. If I'd grown up, you know, 15 minutes in one direction or the other, if it would feel like it was like a treat from another land, or if it would just be like, well, obviously this is what we have at birthday parties. So I don't know. I don't know, man.
It's a work in progress for me.
I
The
want.
continuum.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's a work in progress for me, like acclimating what is the continuum of whiteness.
Yeah.
That's I've always felt so white in this country.
Really?
And then, I saw that wider continuum when I went to college with people who are not Hispanic in any way.
Okay. I want to hear more about that. I want to give people some background about what I know of the work you do, which is that we are both dramaturgs. So you are a theatrical researcher, and you're looking at, and fix any of my language, but you're looking at ways that people sort of present on stage, how we tell our stories, what the context is that makes it important. And so you're looking at things like language and race and piñatas and whiteness and geography through a lens that most of us don't really pay as much attention to as we could. And you make art based on that, or you help other people make art based on that. I want to hear more about the project that involves piñatas. And the thing that we were going to talk about initially was code switching from English to Spanish, particularly when it comes to getting an idea from being an idea to being something that's on the stage. So with that mass interpretation of what I believe to be your work, can you tell me more about the phone call that you had this morning and the project that you're working on?
So that project is called the Funyata.
Ooh.
The Funyata, and the pronunciation is actually very important, is a mixture of the word fun and piñata. You can imagine the challenge it is for people to talk about it around a table, because it demands for you to speak the first part of the word with an American oral posture and then switch to Spanish oral posture. So it's called the Funyata. It's one of my I'm co-founding an organization with some local colleagues to dedicate ourselves to creating Latino theater. And the Fañata is one of our inaugural projects. It's one I'm dramaturging and directing with a playwright who's from here and has inevitably moved away because you can't really have a career here.
It here being San Diego specifically, or Chula Vista.
He was not from Chula Vista, but we are doing it in Chula Vista.
Oh, good. Okay.
And it's based on his true story. It's very autobiographical. So his father invented the non-violent piñata.
What is that? Oh, is that the one that has the string?
There are strings.
Tell me more.
I
I'm gonna
don't,
stop guessing.
it's funny for you to say, is that the one that has the strings? Because
I mean,
I do,
they all have to. Okay, yeah. Continue.
yeah, because they're all very different, right? The nonviolent piñata, which is an interactive game and that does not involve destroying the piñata, you can use it again. His father created this device, he patented it, but no one ever bought it. And he did attempt, like he has letters, archives of his attempts to sell it to Disney, to SeaWorld, to I don't remember like which corporate snack or drink brands, but this was something that was out there and is really, really, was really, really captivating to me when my buddy told me about it. And one of the promises he made to his father before his father passed was that he would find a use for the Fañata. So the man being a theater artist, and determined to fulfill the promise, is making a play in honor of his father that finds a use for that Fañata.
And so, with it being, I have a hunch about why the play is called Vignetta. And I remember seeing vignettas that you weren't supposed to hit. And as a kid, thinking, well, what's the fun in that? And is that sort of where the tension point is in this play, or with the issue that your friend's father had in marketing it, or is that just me having so few opportunities to hit anything with a stick, and just deciding that that's what this play's about?
It's kind of it's really really it, I consider it an intersectional piece, and intersectional pieces tend to enthrall me, and it's global too. So when I say it's autobiographical, you know, he's touching on his origin story in terms of being a first generation American. There's a really large component of his gayness. And equally, there's a religious investigation, having grown up Jehovah's Witness.
Oh,
So
that's
in
an
terms
interesting
of
combo.
social location, he's really, really going about the wheel to understand who he is with an audience, but also in the theatrical device of trying to sell the piñata like he promised he would for his father, but in a fictionalized way. And so everything you said is true and more.
I like it when I guess right sometimes, but that sounds so much more interesting than what I could have imagined on my own. This brings me back. Well, okay, so we've been talking about you doing work as a dramaturg. A question I've been starting to ask everybody: what is dramaturgy?
You want to know from me?
Yeah, I want to know from you.
Yeah, because I have the definition of dramaturgy.
I love it.
I have my own, and I'm on my way towards memorizing it. I consider dramaturgy as being the art of building bridges through the lens of story across between thought, feeling, and experience across all different kinds of divides.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah,
Yeah.
okay.
And it's really my way of avoiding what what people often associate as being the researcher or the expert, some kind of authority in the room, because I don't like doing that. I started dramaturgy really as a cultural advocate and as a consultant, and that is my angle into all of my dramaturgical work.
Something that I've been hearing from the dramaturgs we've had on, I had Jenna Rogers, another dramaturg we know. We recorded that podcast a couple weeks ago, and one of the things she said about the job is that it's being the person who knows what some of the right questions are to ask.
Exactly.
And at least the people that you and I tend to associate with in this profession tend to be a lot less on the academic expert, emperor of knowledge side, and more in the like, but what does it mean? And
Oh
they're
yeah, we're all super contemplative and liberal and inclusive like that.
Gosh, it's a good point. I don't think I've ever met a non-politically progressive dramaturg.
They're out there.
I know they are, and I think that you can get that kind of job with that kind of mindset in really specific kinds of work. Like I could imagine that being a really good fit for. Okay, let's say this is a job that somebody's already done. So this is, and I have no idea who it was, but being like. The Imagineer who did the queue theming on the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland. Like that's very research heavy. It's adapting a story and bringing it to an audience that's right there. It's got this engagement piece. It needs to ask these questions, but I could absolutely have that see that being designed without any hiccups by somebody whose personal beliefs were like, well, I don't know, if poor people didn't want to be poor, maybe they should work harder. But in terms of just like dramaturgs who get really excited about the profession as like holistically, I think we're all pinkos, just like down to the last drop. Anyway, little something to think about. If there are any conservative dramaturgs listening who want to come on, I do want to hear about it. But if you tell me that poor people are poor because they deserve to be poor, then I'll probably argue a lot with you. But I do want to hear how you approach your work.
You know, I just gotta say, I think I had a textbook dramaturgical response when you prompted me with the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland. I was there just a few days ago with my mom for her birthday, and as we entered the ride, I was like, "Never, when I was little, would I have asked which culture or which area of the world is this supposed indigenous remains of a civilization taking place." And as you were speaking to me, I literally started to look it up.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'm
Like,
not finished, but
what
like
was that?
when I went through the ride, I was looking at the symbology and the artifacts, and I was like, I can't tell. This could be somewhere in Central Asia, it could be in the African continent, or it could be somewhere in the Americas,
Yeah,
I think.
it is kind of a mishmash. God, I remember when that ride opened. Some friends and I ditched school to go to like the grand opening with parental permission because someone had to drive us. And at the time, they had created a really rich dramaturgical experience with all these like characters walking around, and everybody got a card that was like how to translate the glyphs on the wall. And you spent a lot more time in the line, so you watched a lot. There was a lot more signage to read, and you watched that video loop many, many, many times. Like, all I was really able to gather for certain was that it was something colonial, like something with a colonial presence. But that I would actually be really interested to like dive into their theming packet, their like thematic dramaturgy packet to go with that.
Bengalese.
You think so?
I think so.
Ooh.
I had a feeling it'd be somewhere in South Asia. I know this is super off topic.
That's and this
Sorry,
whole the
listeners.
whole podcast is off topic, so yeah, that's fine. Bengalese,
Yeah, I just had a feeling, definitely not because of the alphabet. Particularly with the animals that I saw, and and the figures of people that were drawn, they did not seem to represent what is the indigenous facial structures of the Americas. And so I wondered, maybe this is something over in that side of the world.
I did used to work on the Jungle Cruise, which shares, that little
I could see
river
you doing that.
area.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I know
I
that.
did that for a good long while.
Yeah.
So when you go, so that little area over the river that you can see, does have a Bengal tiger, which means that Bengalese could work, but it does, they do say you're entering the ancient Cambodian shrine when you get over there.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, well, on the, but that's so I don't know to what extent you like what the bleed over is from one ride to another. You could see one from the other. And so the Jungle Cruise, that part of the Jungle Cruise does have to be part of like the queue theming, unless you just like put up a brick wall. But I don't know narratively if those worlds are supposed to intersect at all, like over that little fence. Like, you've got shared trees and some shared statues, or not statues, but like some ruins. I think Bengalese is an excellent guess. I wonder if we could find definitive answers in a sequel podcast.
Yeah, a sequel podcast is certainly off topic to what we were going to talk about, and I'm far from an expert or even informed
That's
reader.
cool. Okay. I would like to hear more going back in. So you gave me that super good dramaturgy definition, which I am into. And so the work that you're doing, Can you tell me more about how you are building bridges or bridging language and culture with your current and upcoming and past projects?
Yeah, I mean it's worth this might seem silly, but it's worth establishing then that we're not literally building bridges.
Sure. Yeah.
And I know it sounds unnecessary, but you know, this is a definition that I rehearse for people who are not of the field, and that is a question they will ask. But we build bridges between thought, feeling, and experience, and so really, that is how I approach all of my dramaturgical work. Alongside the question, what kind of hatred is this story combating?
Ooh, okay.
But just as an example, bridging feelings. This project with the Funyata, I feel like its target audience are the people, much like myself, who grew up first generation in this country, or people who have relatives on both sides of our border to come together and relate to each other on our varying levels of Americanness, and feel like we're not alone. So that's something that we're honing in on in our devising process.
How far away from production, is the Funyata at this point?
This is going to open and close in the month of March 2019.
Okay, so it's kind of around the corner, at least in terms from a development timeline perspective. Okay, great.
We're still,
What?
of course, it's being written, and a lot of it's going to be improvised because it's going to be interactive. But we've started to meet regularly to craft out the vision.
Great. What's the, if you said it, I didn't catch it, the name of the group that you're working with.
It's called Tuyo.
How do you spell that?
Capital T, lowercase u, capital Y, lowercase o.
Oh, okay. I get
Yeah.
it. Now that I see it written down.
Yeah. Not everyone does, though. So if you'd like a walkthrough, I'm happy to explain.
Yeah, well, can you with a wide variety of listeners, can you explain the name for us all?
Absolutamente. So, do you know what tú means?
That is you, like,
Yes.
okay.
Do you know what yo means?
That is me.
Do you know what the word tuyo means?
No.
It means yours.
Oh, okay.
And so the idea being, it takes you and me to be linked to make something that is for you.
Oh, that's very nice. I like it.
Yeah.
Two lessons in to Duolingo so that I can learn Spanish. Started 3 days ago, so I'm on pace. But this is something that you have been working on. Well, all of us at Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas have been sort of theoretically aware that there is a huge language barrier for an organization that is meant to be working with all of the Americas, but most of us, I think, are monolingual English speaking. And like I could read French, but that doesn't really, I mean, that helps with the French Canadians only on email. And so we as an organization need to be better about it. And that's something that I've been like sort of thinking and saying for a long time, and I don't know why it wasn't until earlier this week that I was just like, oh shit, I could just learn Spanish. I'll just learn Spanish and stop being an asshole. So I'm working on it. So I got to I've got, I'm as far in my lesson as knowing what to and yo means, even though I probably hopefully would have already known that just from like living in this part of the country. But I hadn't gotten so far as to know what they mean when they come together. So thank you for taking me through it.
Hey, I think in your defense, There's so many people with Spanish-speaking backgrounds who, some are not even born in this country, but who live in this country and will forget their native language or not be taught to speak their language. And so,
Yeah.
I think we all deserve a little bit more credit for why we do. You
Yeah,
know what I mean?
it makes sense. And I know in the neighborhood that I grew up in, even though it was like so a multinational, it seemed to me that there was a real pressure for everybody to get together and speak English, like from the parents who were, new immigrants, that assimilation engine. But and I know in my most recent immigrants in my family are from Norway, and it was the same sort of like, okay, well, we're here, so we speak English now. And my great grandfather literally changed his name to John Johnson when he got here. He's like, this
Wow.
is so like my name, my first name translates to John. My father was also a Johan. So I'm Johan, son of Johan, therefore I am John Johnson. Okay, let's go. I'm doing this. I'm Americaning now. And I guess it's my
Wow.
great great grandfather. Yeah. And it going from, I think at, it's hard to tell because the records but from before he became John Johnson are hard to find because they didn't they, he was John Johnson then. So but I think it was Johan Mortvek. But who could say? Nobody knows how to spell it. Nobody like It's just kind of like, okay, well, that was who you were 20 minutes ago. Right now and moving forward, let's get with the American program. So yeah, I think that the we young folk are starting to, I think there's a cultural shift where people are wanting to reconnect with their languages of origin, be able to connect with other people in their community better. It seems to me that it is kind of new in American culture to want that for, non-academic reasons, just to like know people better, to know ourselves better, not like, well, I'm going to need this if I'm going to get that job.
Well, people all over the world, you might have learned this already. People all over the world associate monolingualism with being American. Now, this is obviously not everywhere. You know, I say that with a lot of arguable first world privilege, but yeah, that's how Europeans perceive Americans. And though not every person in Latinoamérica knows English, if you attend academic institutions in your upbringing, it's very, very likely you're going to take an English class. And I've known some people who haven't been allowed to graduate until they learn English.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that in Europe or is that just sort of like everywhere that's not the United States?
Well, I'm thinking particularly some parts of Latin America.
Okay.
Though I'd imagine that might be in some institutions in Europe as well, or even definitely in Asia. Yeah, I mean, just like generally, Americans, people of the United States are the most comfortable being monolingual.
And have you found that to be true in other English-speaking countries too? Like in England, is there still that same tendency to be like, well, everybody speaks English, so I'll just keep doing that? Or have
I don't
they
know.
tacked some German on as well since,
Well, it helps that they are an island. Regardless of, being in Europe where every country speaks a different freaking language. I don't know. I haven't done enough traveling around the UK. I know that I have met people from the UK who speak other languages in my travels elsewhere. Like, I remember it was actually one thing at Granada in Spain, not in Latin America, and I met a Scotsman who spoke Spanish better than my Mexican friend who was with me. Well, this guy actually grew up in Downey, so he's, also
Really?
America's like myself. But that's just the reality is that, That's what I was speaking to earlier. Like, growing up in this country is a language compromise. And for some of us, that's actually very disturbing.
Can you say more about that?
Sure. I felt really, really largely defined by my cultural experience. And that cultural experience is even further defined by my language identities. I grew up speaking Spanish at home. To be more specific, until I went to school, Spanish was is all I can really remember. And then I attended a and then I attended kindergarten, where I think, yeah, that's really where it all began, the juggle. And for a few years, my family still makes fun of me for this. I insisted on only speaking English.
At home too.
Probably.
Okay.
Or if not, I probably spoke Spanish very, very sloppily or lazily or scornfully.
Scornfully. Okay.
Yeah, and I know I'm not the only one. It wasn't really until I was like 10 or 11 years old where I was like, okay, that's enough.
Like, I'm done being a dick about this now, or like that's
Basically,
okay.
I said this to someone last night. I don't know how to tell you. This is every day of my life. This person I spoke to was feeling guilty about how they didn't learn Spanish when they could have, to honor their family. And most people don't realize that when you're young, you don't have that kind of foresight. You're just
Right.
trying to survive, and
Yeah.
surviving is not just like eating or being alive, it's also, having friends and going to school.
Yeah.
But at 10 years old, I was like, okay, I guess I had that foresight and I decided to be more disciplined about it.
So I live in Eagle Rock in Los Angeles, really close to Highland Park, and this is a parts of Highland Park in particular are it's gentrifying really fast, and a point of contention has been these murals on like the bodegas that have been there forever. The bodegas are going out, the coffee shops are coming in, some it's usually in scare quotes, local artist comes in and does a very beautiful mural on top of the old community mural that's very like it's usually got the Instagram handle on it, and it's just very shiny, and it's sort of presenting as honoring the neighborhood heritage, but like revitalized. But there's also in this east part of LA where I am, there's a lot of tension between the Hispanic community, some members of the Hispanic community who've been here for generations, and the younger wealthy people coming in. Something that I've been seeing in the very, very heated Instagram comments about the neighborhood and the new murals is there are a lot of people whose families have been here for a long time that are kind of getting into it, like on the way progressive side, getting into it with each other. Like, if you were really serious about this, you would have commented in Spanish, and that's how I know that you're terrible. And then coming back with Spanish is the colonial language of the oppressors, and I do not speak it because I want to honor my ancestors. And English isn't any better, but I don't want to, like, I don't want to give the Spanish colonizers any more power over me than they've already had. And so this is just like the shit going down in my neighborhood right now over Spanish versus Spanglish versus English versus we actually have a ton of local languages like in this neighborhood, but there, it seems like a lot of people are sort of feeling it's definitely polarizing. So there's a connection with the language and a distance from the language.
Yeah, it is polarizing, and it doesn't have to be. It's something I always think about, especially with those of us who have that that historical sensitivity.
Yeah, so what I was wondering is that with you and in your family and in your with your friends and community, was there at the time any of that, well, no, actually, I don't speak Spanish because I want to honor my ancestors, or was that only the if you weren't speaking Spanish, it was something that you just were made to feel like a dick about later?
I just did that thing where I didn't, where you don't process the second part of a question because you're so
Yeah. No,
used to
that's
the
okay.
answer.
Just say whatever you want. It's all good.
Later I will give you my politic on this,
Sure,
but
sure.
I'll give you my context first. It's complicated as it is for all of us, for my family, because my father was Mexican and his parents were Mexican. And my mother was Mexican, but her parents immigrated to Mexico from the Middle East.
Oh, that's very interesting. Okay,
And
okay.
so there's this dynamic of what people often call what being whitewashed or Americanized or assimilated into the US, where you lose your original first culture. My mother experienced the same thing as she integrated as a Mexican person. And so her Arabic is like so minimal, and mine was even more minimal growing up.
Did you have grandparents who spoke Arabic that you were around, or with all that moving, was it just hard to keep those roots?
Well, we moved down to San Diego specifically so we could be closer to them because
Oh, good.
they lived in Tijuana,
Oh,
border city,
that's nice.
yeah. And I actually just started understanding recently that being Mexican in San Diego doesn't mean you have family in Tijuana. I thought it meant that for everybody, but I realize now people might be from, the lower states, from the interior of the country, or from Nicaragua, for example. Anyway, when it comes to the justice of the language of my ancestors, I don't think I could adequately do that, and I don't even believe in it. I don't think that's how it could or should be done. Yeah, that's my politic, is that you speak the language you speak because, based on whatever circumstances, mostly very privileged ones, and a lot of people would hate me for saying that, but it's true. I think being in this country, regardless of where you are, is some version of privilege. And I've had people who are from East LA or from Detroit or certain parts of New York who will hate me for that. But it's just how I see it, having grown up in this border town and seeing how the other halves live, Yeah, so I never condemn or pressure people to conform to another language. I don't see there's any more justice in speaking Spanish to those ancestors. There might be to your grandparents or your parents or whoever had influence over you, but they are also, this is something I'm really passionate about. What we call Latinidad, the identity of being Latinx. Latinidad is not defined by speaking Spanish.
That's Latinidad with a D at the end.
Yeah, so it's
Okay.
like Latinidad.
Okay, Latinidad. Okay.
And that's something I don't think I have a lot of company on in terms of like my political POV. The reality of that is, and please let me know if this too soapbox are out of topic,
Nah, get up
off
there, man.
topic. The reality is, so many people, and many of them are in this country, associate Spanish with the integral part of being Latino or Latinx, as their way of differentiating themselves from the privileged majority. And this is often what I would consider either the mestizo or the whiter person of the Latino experience, since it can be a little overwhelming to process your levels of privilege, you know. So to be told you're basically white, but you happen to speak Spanish is upsetting. Yeah.
That would be a lot. That would be a lot to take in. And do you find that that sentiment gets passed around very much? And I'm thinking particularly about our artistic communities where we're creating and do tend to be a little bit more politically aware and sometimes a little bit more polarizing and sometimes just mean.
It all depends on, like, some of it depends on region. It also depends on the space, like if it's a professional artistic space or the class levels, for example, how aware we are of what I call whiteness in Latino America. Yeah, I think in general, the white European originated American public associates Latinidad with brownness. So regardless of how pale one person can be, if our viewers could see, they would see that I do not look anything like their expectations of a Latino person. I still get perceived as brown, and it's awkward.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I've had people tell me like, "You as a brown person," and I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa! Where did that
Hold
come from?"
up. Hold up, I'm super pasty. I'm not saying that you are super
Right.
pasty, but yeah, that seems like that would be jarring. Yeah, that seems jarring.
Yeah. So there's that. And there's also the opposite of a lot of it has to do with education. Or actually, no. I don't know what to tell you, Kate, because
That's fine.
it might be high levels of education where we're, quote with Not quote, where we're woke with quotes around it, and able to determine, okay, well, this is a white person, but with Spanish ancestry, regardless of their Mexican citizenship, or it might be the complete opposite. Someone who's had, for example, virtually no education, and sees things on those lanes of like, you are a brown person, and you must only be brown.
You must only be brown. And as so I work with a lot of comedy theaters out here in LA, and know a lot of people sort of in the stand-up world. So there, in some ways, there's a little bit more room to just have these conversations that are sometimes subtext, to just have them be the surtext and just get up on a microphone and talk about these are the things that I'm experiencing right now. So it's been interesting in since the 2016 election, and particularly with all the talk about I don't even want to say the words, but the damn wall, and
The demo.
the damn wall. And because I don't really want to get into like the immediately political bits right now, but I think that the identity piece is hugely important, and people do feel attacked in my neighborhood, and I have to assume in your neighborhood too. But there, women who are getting up on the mic and talking about their background, it's a lot of women, well, people in LA, but women who I happen to know, are saying like, okay, so yes, I am Mexican, but I'm fourth generation American, and like my grandparents kind of spoke Spanish, and I'm trying to learn it, but apart from like looking tan, they don't have that, language wise, don't have the don't even really have the Spanglish any better than anybody else living in the neighborhood. So it's just, I don't know, it's something that
Who's to say that they're not Latino, right?
Say it again.
And who's to say that they're not Latino?
Yeah, and they say I'm Latino, but or Latina in those cases, but they're so they feel that, but they don't. What they're expressing is more a, oh, I don't know what it is. It's like a distancing from a newer immigrant, and I don't know if that's a reflexive, like, don't deport me, we've been here for 150 years, or if it is, I don't know what it is. But it seems like the language piece. It seems like the fact that I'm seeing so many people with Mexican ancestry, like, volunteer, like, I don't speak Spanish. My parents don't speak Spanish. My grandparents kind of sort of speak Spanish, but they suck at it. The fact that I'm seeing people who feel like they need to have that on a t-shirt before they walk out
That's
into the
true.
world as a brown person, because I'm thinking particularly about people who do have a darker skin tone, who really appear like they're Latino. How do you think that the language, you talked to me about the, what you didn't call it, Spanglish, it's a
Spanglishism.
Spanglishism. How do you think that in the current political climate, informs the kind of art and public speaking that people with Mexican heritage are able to do in this country right now? I don't know if that question made as much sense as I wanted it to. It's like, I'm trying to bridge my own thoughts and feelings.
Yeah, we all are, right? That's called dramaturgy.
Right. Watch the act of dramaturgy of me slurring sentences.
Yeah. Well, some passionate bullet points that I was mentally charting was that it's all true. Okay, that sounds really ambiguous. As in, there is a place for all of it. As my point being, there are people in this country who've lived also their lived their lives defined by being Latino or Latina or Latinx. But if they were to interact with people not of the United States and virtually anywhere else in Latin America, it's very likely they would be perceived or even labeled as not Latino because they are of the United States or because they don't speak Spanish. And that is actually regardless of their pigment. Now, there are also people, like I said, there's a place for all of it. There are also people who'll be like, well, that person is Latino, not because of their heritage or their Spanish speaking. But because they're brown, and their brownness makes me think they are of the Occidental world of the Americas in some way. The logic, all the logics exist, and sometimes they intersect, or they're in their own nebulas. I've even argued very recently with an intimate friend of mine from Peru. Who basically called someone who was much like me not Latino, and I was like, the amount of the level of rage that
I
some
was gonna
people
ask,
would take to that, you know.
yeah, did that feel prickly for you, or like offensive, or was it just interesting?
I've grown so tolerant. Like I said, like this has been every day for me since I was little. Like especially being, for most of my family, me and my sisters were the only ones on this side of the border.
Oh, really? Your parents aren't this way anymore, up here?
What'd you say?
Your parents
They're
aren't.
here, but what I
Oh,
mean is in
okay.
terms of our generation, like
Okay,
we are
okay.
first generation American,
Oh, I
reborn and
see.
raised here.
Yeah, so no, like, if you want to see cousins, you've got to cross an international border.
Exactly.
Okay.
Not just any international border, like it is statistically the busiest one in the world. So I, like I said, I'm very tolerant of that kind of sentiment. And it's been a process of growth for me to accept and embrace all those privileges and why people would perceive those things.
Mm-hmm.
Let them and learn to listen and ask why. But other people don't, you know. I think living in LA with the distance, San Diego really is that, as that cushion, makes it much easier to exist in this country as a Latino or Latinx person and not have that worldliness. And I hate to call it worldliness because it feels almost elitist to say, like, you haven't traveled, have you? But
But I know what you mean though, especially in a lot of parts of East LA, like if you don't have a car, if you don't, you're in East LA. Like if you go, and I feel like if I've got to go to Santa Monica for something, I sometimes joke that it feels like international travel, but it would take me not that much longer to get to actual Mexico than to get to Santa Monica or anywhere on the West Side. And so it can be very, you're right with that cushion of Orange County and San Diego being in between. If you don't have either transportation or enough time off work to go anywhere, like it might as well be the moon to have the border be, 2.5 hours south or three or whatever it is.
I know people who've even lived here, and I've never been to Mexico. And it's literally visible from where I'm sitting right now.
So like I don't have to go, I could see it from here.
Yeah, maybe that's what that's their mindset, right? Like, why should I go? I can see it, and it's not that great.
It's not that great, PS.
That's how some people perceive it.
That's weird.
But yeah, when people not of this country offer that kind of sentiment, I mean, my automatic response is like, well, you just don't know, you know? So it's almost the same applies to them, you know? They're not worldly or informed. So no one really gets to police identity like that.
That's, I mean, if there's a takeaway quote, I think that's probably it. And we're coming up on being out of time, but I do want to know, in terms of what you would like to see, from the performing arts, whether theater or film or Indiana Jones rides, what changes in practice would you like to see be adopted widely if you got to wave the magic wand right now?
I'm torn because I remember the prompt being around code switching, and I have some things to offer there.
Please do. Yeah, it's a fluid podcast, basically. Starts with who are you and what are you doing, and then it just kind of goes. So tell me more about code switching.
Yeah, I guess if this is too long, you can just cut out a lot of
No,
the
that's
language.
fine.
I'll start with the code switching, and then I'll start with, I think, the more general practices. There is a genre or a sub-genre for what some people call Latinx theater. And not everyone agrees with me that a play does not need to be bilingual in order to be Latinx. But I'm resting my case on that. With theater that aspires to be code switching, I would like to see the Spanish language integrated in a way so that it's more than sprinkled across the story, or it's more than accenting, pardon my pun, for certain parts of the story. I would like to see bilingual plays, and this actually goes outside of the Spanglish theme, for all plays that are bicultural in some sort of way. I'd like to see them created and written in ways that are inclusive to monolingual audiences on both sides. So if I were to create an Arabic English play for you to speak Arabic and be able to follow the story as an Arabic listener, or for you to speak English and follow the story as an English listener, and only have a more enhanced experience by being both.
I think that's really, that seems, strikes me as something that's very important, because I've seen a lot of theater, both in English and in Spanish, that presents as though it is bridging a gap, but it just has captions, which is different.
Yeah,
And
it's
not
super
that that's,
different.
yeah, not that that's not valuable, but it's like you're just not doing the thing that you said you're gonna do.
Exactly. Most recently, I've been advocating for what is the translation, not just in terms of the language, but in terms of the poetic values of the language. So, for example, when you create Shakespeare, when you perform Shakespeare, we recognize the rhythm and the rhyme. But when people translate Shakespeare, it's just like, it's very direct. It's just like gross transliteration.
Like, do you like gross as in like a little disgusting?
Gross as in sloppily translating from the English into the Spanish, so that way
Cool.
it's just for comprehension and not for heightened crafted language. So like to
Man.
write with rhyme and to write with the palpitated rhythm is fascinating and worth, I think that's language justice, to say like I'm going to
Yeah.
translate the experience for you as well as the story.
Yeah, my understanding, and I do not speak German well enough to be able to at all. I don't speak German at all. I don't know why I said well enough, but my understanding is that Shakespeare, when translated to German, that it's very valued. Like, oh, this is good. I like this Shakespeare guy. But I have not really had any experience with any writing in translation, like literary writing in translation that is at all good by the time you basically like transliterate it. And gross is the exact word that I used to describe it, which is why I wanted to hone in on that. Be like, are you using a more precise definition of the word gross, or do we just mean this is gross? And it seems like we both just mean that those translations are gross. That's very
What?
cool. Did I lose you for a second? Or are you still?
Yeah, I lost you. You said
Oh.
it seems what?
It seems like we're both on the same page about the definition of just like those translations are gross. So what I would like to ask you before we go, first of all, I would love to have you on again to get into deeper on an individual project or a rabbit hole of thought if you want to another time, because there's so much here. But if someone were to want to hire you to say freelance dramaturg their play that is in some way Spanglish, or to just dramaturg anything where you're going to be bridging some thoughts and feelings, and what's the third thing? Thought, feeling.
Thought, feeling, and experience across any kind of divide.
Where could someone find you?
I do not have a website.
Secret. Okay, so you all can get a hold of me at the context, and I'll tell you where to find Bernardo if you want to hire him.
I mean, you're welcome. If my name is somehow written on the file for this online, you can find me on Facebook. I'll be very friendly to that. They're certainly emailing me through LMDA. If you email the grants and awards address, then that's going to lead to me. And
And that's grants at lmda.org, right?
I think it's awards at LMDA.
Oh no, it's okay. It's
Yeah.
awards at lmda.org.
Which we have to fix because that is confusing.
Okay. What about, are you on the Find a Dramaturg feature on the New Play Exchange?
I'm a terrible member. I do not even know.
This is for National New Play Network's New Play Exchange. It's not even, I mean, it's LMDA affiliated in that we partnered with them to offer like cheaper benefits. But you just check off a box if you're on the New Play Exchange saying, yes, I'm a dramaturg
I
for
might
hire.
be. If I am a member, I haven't been paying attention.
Cool. Okay. Well, great. So, you guys, if you want to hire Bernardo, you're going to have to do your homework. But Bernardo, this episode will go up in like 6 weeks, so you've got time. If you have anything that you want to plug or a particular way that you want people to find you and give you money, or work or like gifts, I don't know. Let me know and I'll put it in the show notes. And
Thank you.
I'll even put a little bumper on it as a little PS if it comes up. Is there anything that you want to add before we go?
I'll say this. Ask all your questions as a dramaturg with who, what, where, when, why, or how.
Well, you, wait, what other words would you use?
People, and these are people, some of our own colleagues, will start their questions with do or
Oh, so
could.
looking for a yes or no instead of a broader open-ended. Oh, okay.
I think that's the ultimate art form of like,
Oh, that's good. So, for example, Bernardo, my dramaturg for this new production of Hamlet, let's say, Bernardo, do you think I could put this, set this in outer space? This is not a good dramaturgical question.
That's not a good dramaturgical question, yeah.
Bernardo, how would the telling of this story be different
Bingo.
if we were to set it in outer space?
Yeah, bingo. That's it, yeah.
All right, that's great. That's really like practical. That is practical advice for living your life right there.
Yeah, it goes through your relationships too, like people will love you when you ask open-ended questions like that. Maybe that's dating advice to your listeners too.
Dating advice. Yeah, well, I'm gonna use it as better. Like, if I were to re-interview you right now, I'm all paranoid. Like, what did I ask you? I asked you, like, do you see this?
No, you didn't.
Okay.
I have it written here. You asked who's, you asked what's, you asked
Phew. Okay.
how.
Okay, good. Because now I'm gonna be completely paranoid about all of my interviews, but hopefully I've got enough like muscle memory just from talking to other dramaturgs and doing a little bit of that theater education. The
Feel
right
free to
questions
re
come out.
Feel free to re-record this if you think it sucked. And if you feel like
No.
something else ought to replace it, just let me know and I will explain why it's important.
I love it. No, and thank you so much for coming on. And actually, I had a lot of really like language clumsy moments in this, but unless you think otherwise, I think it's kind of important for me to keep them in.
I agree.
Okay, cool. 'Cause yeah, I'm trying to get better at how I talk to friends, how I talk about issues, and how my unaccented Spanish is, 'cause it's really rough.
Me too. I want to say this publicly. I'm working on my English every day, and I'm also working on my Spanish every day.
That's good to know. Yeah, I would have just sort of assumed that you'd like, by age 9, let's say, just like checked off the boxes on both languages and been like, I'm a finished product. Into the world I
No.
go.
No, definitely not.
Cool. Thank you so much for being on here today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
All right. I'm gonna push stop. Bye,
All right.
everybody.
Bye, Kate. Bye, everyone else.
Bye,
Take
Bernardo.
care.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Context Podcast. You can learn more about our guest and the topics we covered today by heading to thecontextpod.com. That's thecontextpod.com for exclusive bonus content, including monthly episodes and secret Spotify playlists and some other cool stuff. Become a subscriber by going to patreon.com/thecontextpod. You can also follow along with our adventures on Twitter, where we are @ContextPod. And you can email us all your questions and episode ideas and thoughts and other things, just no dick pics, at thecontextpod@gmail.com. This episode of The Context was made possible by the 2018 Dramaturgy Driven Grant from the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. Learn more about membership and how you could maybe get a grant for doing a thing you like at lmda.org/join. They don't require me to thank them,
but it's a good group of folks, and I'm glad to be involved. They also don't require me to tell you that everything said on this podcast is my own opinion and not necessarily the views of LMDA, but that's also true. I don't think that LMDA would put dick pics in their closing bumper as a phrase to say. Anyway, that's all on me, not on them. Thanks for joining us.